I will be focusing in this talk on the wife of Bath, but I'm going to parenthetically talk about two other tales surrounding her prologue and tale. I will give these tales short shrift, and I apologize because they deserve closer attention and more study. However, the reason I'm doing this is, given my remarks on the Knight's Tale and what the Knight's Tale presents, the working out of those two tales, the Man of Law's Tale and the Clark's Tale, are readily comprehensible if you understand the Knight's Tale. The Wife of Bath is such a peculiar, overwhelming, strange creation that she needs some explanation. So I simply need to spend the time explaining her. I mentioned yesterday that the Canterbury Tales, unfortunately, were never completed. So that we have here really a fragmentary, incomplete work, although it's a very long work. It is a goodly chunk of it got done, and it is a long work in its own right. One can spend a great deal of time studying all of it, and one should. If there are those who are using this for homeschooling purposes, the tales are well worth reading and spending time with. There are many of them that I won't have time to cover, but it's rich and abundant field worth exploring. But because it's unfinished, the work comes to us in fragments. And it's part of what scholars have done in identifying the fragments so that we have chunks of the work. We have the beginning, we have the end, and then we have pieces of it. And nobody knows for certain how Chaucer ultimately intended to arrange those fragments. What order would these tales have come in? Some we have because one chunk will include two or three tales, but then you don't know if that's coming before or after some of the other chunks. So that scholars have attempted to figure out what the order would have been. Needless to say, there's been much debate. What I'm going to do now is posit a possible order and give you my reasons why. The other thing that I need to say is that some of these tales, apparently Chaucer had written at an earlier time in his life. He takes them and then readapts them for one of the pilgrims to tell. So we also have bits and pieces coming from various times in his career. We have early sketches of maybe this person would tell the tale and talk with this one, and we get odd things occasionally in an introduction to a tale that doesn't quite make sense. It's not a perfect work by any means. It's not a perfect work. But I do think, following the Miller's Tale and then the Reeves Tale, which I have skipped over, read it at your peril. It's a bad, dirty joke. If the Miller's Tale is at least clever and funny, the Reeves Tale is neither. It hits the bottom of humanity, and it's just told to be mean. It's merely mean-spirited and vulgar. But we have that whole section, and we know that was the beginning. The general prologue, the Knight's Tale, the Miller's Tale, the Reeves Tale, okay? I am going to suggest that the introduction and tale of the man in law of law probably follows. I won't go into an extensive discussion as to why it's the man of law that tells this story, but let me just say what he is telling is an old folk tale. We get the tale of Dame Constance, she's called. We have an answer to the Miller's Tale. We have an answer to the Miller's Tale. And we have once again a figure speaking up in support of the vision the knight has presented. So that, as I said, these pilgrims all the way along are going to choose sides. They're either siding with the vision of the knight or they're siding with the vision of the miller, and the man of law clearly sides with the knight. In telling the tale, and going through what Constance, the good wife, undergoes, the major themes have to do with marriage and providence. And the other thing that the man of law is doing in telling this old folk tale that has miraculous overtones to it is rejecting the stark realism that both the Miller and the Reeve have descended to. That vision of rough realism in the actual world, and if anything, the man of law is elevating things again to a higher plane. The story he tells, stated very simply, Constance undergoes tremendous suffering. Tremendous suffering. It is a tale that takes her far afield. She's traveling, but she remains the devoted wife throughout. And no matter what is sent to her, she endures it. She remains constant in her faith to her husband. She remains constant in her faith to God. It's as simple as that. So that we can simply say, what the man of law's tale does is reveal the true purpose of marriage and reveal as well the position that a real wife should take. How she should relate to her husband and to the world around her. It also reveals, if you will, an alternate reality, which is not those low, hard facts in life, but that the world and our actions in the world are connected with God's providence. And it is possible to see, visibly enacted in the world, God's design, particularly among those good souls who submit themselves to his will. And we basically have, in the man of law's tale, the tale of a good woman who tries to be a good Christian soul, and in doing so, presents a higher reality. That higher reality is God's reality, which is the permanent truth. And again, simply, what do we have? We have the story of Constance moving throughout the world in what seems to be a series of random movements directed by fortune, in which she suffers immensely, but constantly submits. And as a result, we're again seeing the true pilgrimage through the world. It is a world of suffering, it's a world of woe. But at no time does she lose her faith? Does she complain of what is sent to her? Okay, and in that sense, even at the end with this, the miracle that happens at the end, where clearly the hand of God is present, we see God's design, which at any moment, it's simply a fact, God can work his way in the world and make his presence visible. And it happens at the end of that tale. It's a lovely tale. I'm sorry to skip over it. It deserves study. But I think it can be understood by simply saying the man of law is supporting what the knight has said and giving us a different tale that deals with those themes in much of the same way. Now, what follows next? We don't know, because the man of law's tale stands by itself. It's a fragment that stands by itself. Where would it have been placed? We can't say for certain. But I do think what happens is that surrounding the wife of Bath's prologue and tale, we get two variations of that same theme. What's on the other side of the wife of Bath's prologue and tale? The Clark's tale, which is similar to the man of law's tale. And indeed, what we have there is the tale of patient Griselda. Again, the story of a good woman who is suffering untold reverses of fortune and immense suffering as she makes her way through the world. And indeed, if anything, what the Clerk of Oxford does is intensify the nature of that suffering. There are some who claim that actually the story is an absurdity and reaches the level of farce because of the immense, endless suffering that this woman, Griselda, has to undergo. The reason that that is a bad reading of the Clark's tale is because the Clark, throughout his tale, is invoking and bringing up reminiscences of the book of Job. To claim that the Clark's tale of patient Griselda is farcical because of the immensity of the suffering would be to make the claim that the book of Job is ridiculous because of all of the sufferings visited upon Job. And the fact of the matter is, Job is serious stuff and we know it. So that what the Clark is doing in his tale is showing how a single individual Christian soul may be forced to undergo something similar to what Job went through. One blow after another. One time of suffering followed by another. Just at the moment when you think this good woman can't bear anymore, she is hit with something else. And it comes to the end, and she endures. She keeps her faith, she endures, and we have the vision again of the good wife, the good woman, which is in contradistinction to what we get in the Miller, with the Miller, and also what we'll see in the wife of Bath's tale. Okay. I'm going to read just a passage from the end of the Clark's tale, because he explains the lesson in case we've missed it. If you want to turn in the Clark's tale, it's right near the end of his story. Let me see if I can find this quickly here. I should have marked it ahead of time. Maybe I got a page. 352, thank you very much. It's in a different order in this book. And again, that's... Okay, it's the bottom of 353. 353, okay. He actually comes out and says, and this is the bottom of 353, "This story is said not for that weavers should have fallen Griselda as in humility, for it were importable, though they wolde. Not every wife should be expected to be as humble as Griselda." That would be insupportable. We cannot, if everyone in the world had to go through such suffering, it would be insupportable. If every human being born into the world had to go through what Job went through, it would create almost an impossibility. Because most people aren't strong enough. Most people couldn't endure it. So he says, look, I didn't tell you this story saying that every wife should expect to go through what Griselda went through. You can't all expect to have this. That's not the reason I told this story. "But for that every wicht in his degree should be constant in adversity as was Griselda." You shouldn't expect to have such misfortune heaped like hot coals on your head endlessly. But in your position and in your degree, you will suffer. And what you should learn is patience to that degree. That's why I told the story. "For since the woman was so patient unto a mortal man, well morus octa reciven all in gray that God us sent." It's her husband that puts most of the suffering on her. Just to test her. Now let's test her some more. Oh, she passed that test. Let's make it worse. I'll test her again. It wouldn't make logical sense in a world, but what we learn from is her patience, and that we should receive in our degree whatever God sends to us. This is, if you will, this story has been an emblem of how we deal with the sufferings that God sends to us. Okay, he makes that very clear. It's appropriate that the Clark tells a story and then tells us the lesson. He's a scholar, he's a student, here's the story I told, and at the end he says, here's the lesson I meant to teach, and he makes it very clear. Now, I am positing that these two stories of good wives, humble, patient Christian souls, surround the wife of Bath's tale. We are led into her with one, and following her we get a deep breath with another, because boom, here she is, my friends, okay? This is one of Chaucer's great creations. Once you've met her, you can't forget her. She is extraordinary, and I skipped over her in the prologue again, so let's go back to the prologue for the first introduction to her. She She comes right after the physician, right before the parson. She's right before the parson. A good weef was there of beside Abatha, but she was some deal deaf, and that was Scatha. She's slightly deaf. We're going to find out why. Of cloth making, she had a switch and haunt. She passed hem of Ypres and of Gaunt. She's got talent. She can make cloth. She's good at it. In all the parish weef, no was there none that to the offering before her should have gone. When it came time to give the public offerings, no other woman dared go up before she did. Okay. It's just this. It's one of the first things we hear about her. This is a measure of her piety. I'm going up and giving my gifts first. Don't you dare. I love it. And if there did a certain, so wroth was she that she was out of all a charity. If some other woman got to the altar to give their little offering before she did, that was the end of her charity. She was, okay. Her cover chiefs full fiend awaren of groaned, he durst a swear they wired in 10 pound that on a Sunday wearing upon her head. She's wearing 10 pounds of scarves and headcloths around her head when she goes to Sunday Mass. Nobody's got so much. She makes that cloth and she makes it to wear on her own head. She's going to show up and she's going to look more impressive than any of the other women, or at least there's going to be more of it than anybody else has. This is a woman, we get the sense, of size, volume, and magnitude. This is not a tiny lady in any way, not in her personality, not in her clothes, and probably not in her person. Her hosen were of fiend scarlet red, full straighty tied, and chooses full moist and newer. Bold was her fossa, and fair and red of hue. She's got a fair face, okay, but it's a bold face, and it's a red face, matching her stockings. She was a worthy woman all her leva. Husbands at church adore, she had a fever. She's outlived 5 husbands. She's made 5 marriages. With oot another company in youthe, but thereof nadeth not to spake as nothe. Okay? And she knew other men in her youth, but we won't talk about that here. Chaucer the Pilgrim passes over that one. Oh, no, we're not going to. And 3 had she been at Jerusalem, she had a passed many a strange astrem. 3 times she's made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. 3 times she's come back. And in fact, she's made many pilgrimages and passed many a strange stream. Remember the word strange. And palmers for to sake a strange strondas. Those are the other group. We've got the pilgrims filled with the desire from God to make a serious pilgrimage. We have the palmers for to sake a strange strondas. Those who are going on pilgrimages for their own reasons or to say they've been there. Well, the word strange shows up again here. And Chaucer is identifying her with that second group that's taking pilgrimages for a personal reason. What we're going to find out is this is one of the ways she comes up with new husbands. And it's pretty clear she's heading off on this pilgrimage to Canterbury because she's just buried the 5th. Although we will find, when we actually look closely, it's unclear whether number 5 is alive or dead. She refers to him in both the past and the present tense. It may be she's just worn him down so he's on death's door, and before he goes, she's off looking for number 6, okay? But we can't say for certain, it remains a mystery. But we know that she has used the opportunity of previous pilgrimages to find new husbands. Okay? She had a passed many a strange stream. She certainly has. Her reason for pilgrimage is not the proper one. At Roma she had been, and at Bologna, at Galice, at St. James, and at Colonia. She could have much loved wandering by the wire. She knew much of wandering off in strange ways. Gat tothed was she, sothly for to sire. She has a gap between her front teeth. In the Middle Ages, that was considered very sensual. Who knows why? I don't know. Who knows why? But the point is, she has been given that mark of sensuality, a gap between her front teeth. Upon an ambler aisle she sat, a wimpled well, and on her head and hat, as broad as is a buckler or a target. She has this gigantic hat on her head, as big as a buckler or as a target. A fort mantle about her hip is larger, and on her fate a pair of spore is sharper. Her horse is going to move forward. She's going to be in the front. She's wearing spurs to keep that horse moving. Get the picture. This gigantic hat, cloth all around her, and spurs on her to keep that horse moving fast. In fellowship well called she Lochfa and Carpa. She's good company. She laughs. We can bet loudly. And she talks a lot. Of remedies of lova she canoe perchanza, for she coda of that art, the old adonsa. She knows a lot about love and the remedies of love and what love is all about because she knows, I love the phrase, the old adonsa. She knows that ancient dance of love. Now, that's the portrait we get of her. Woof, scary stuff, scary stuff. Please notice when we come to her prologue and tale, the prologue is much longer than the tale. It's the only case of that. The tale is fairly short, fairly concise, but getting to the tale, the woman speaks forever. Her chance comes, she starts talking, and before she can get to her tale, she tells us everything about herself and her life, giving away much more than she intends to. What is very curious here, and what again makes a very complex character, and this is part of the beauty of Chaucer, he is clearly showing this woman up for what she is. She is a willful woman. She is a woman out of control. She is, if you will, the real vision of what a woman who has mastery in the world turns into. Not sweet, pretty little 18-year-old Alisoon of the Miller's Tale. Curiously, her name is Dame Alice, and she is occasionally called Alisoon as well. Chaucer is making the connection. We get these two similar names, okay? You get a woman who achieves power over men, and it's not going to be the sweet, pretty little 18-year-old who's sleek as a weasel. You're going to get this great, huge, overwhelming, crushing creature that will kill five husbands. And not be satisfied with that, be off looking for a sixth. This is what you get. And when she starts talking, you're not going to be able to shut her up. On she goes and on she goes. And the more she talks, trying to explain who she is, why she lives the way she does, why she's had the life she has, Chaucer, in the midst of it, makes us feel a small degree of sympathy with her. Chaucer is filled with Catholic charity, even for such a grotesque soul, but what he remembers is that this Weef of Botha has a soul. And he reminds us something that it's easy to forget when we come upon those extraordinary, overwhelming, off-putting sinners who live in the world. They are our brethren. They have souls to be saved, just as we do. And for all of their fallen nature, we too are fallen. For all of their problems, they are still human. They need redemption. And we're all in it together. We're all on the same journey together. We'll look and see how he does it. He does it beautifully. He does it beautifully. So at the same time I'm being critical of her here, and he's clearly critical of her, we get something more. We get something more. Now, she starts out. She starts out, and she announces at the very beginning a theme that's going to run through many of these tales. And she's the one who states it. experience though non auctorite were in this world, is rich enough for me to speak of woe that is in marriage. Experience is not necessarily authority, but I've had enough experience in this world that it's okay. I'm going to tell you about the woe that is in marriage. It's a theme that runs through many, many, many of the tales. And what I'll try to do later is point out how, in a curious way, the fact and problems of marriage connect with everything, the entire vision of the longer poem. For lording synth I 12 yar was of age, thanked be God that is eterne on leave. Husbands at churched or I've have a had fever. If ye so often meek to have ye wedded bay, and all were worthy men in her degree. But May was told, certain, not long agone is, that since the Christ now went an ever but honest to wedding in the Cana of Galilee, that by the same example talked to he May that he should ne shoulder wedded bay but onus. Hark ache, lo, what a sharp word for the nonus. Beseda, a weller Jesu, God and man, spack in reprieve of the Samaritan, though hast he had fever whose bundes, quote he, and that ilka man that knew hath they is knocked thine whose bund. Thus said he certain. With that he meant thereby he cannot sign, but that I ax a why that the fifth man was known husband to the Samaritan. Who many mikta she have in marriage? Yet heard I never a telling in menage upon this nombre definition. Well, look, it's a troubled soul. It's a troubled conscience. Somebody said to her recently, Christ only went to one wedding in Galilee, in Cana of Galilee that we know of. Therefore, one wedding's enough. Why have you been married 5 times? Well, she doesn't understand that. But immediately she thinks of the woman at the well, and Christ saying to her, that man isn't your husband. Well, but then how many husbands can you have? Now, admittedly, she's had them one at a time. She's troubled by it. And the trouble has to do with her view of marriage. But she starts with saying, no, the trouble's about number. But nobody's ever defined definitively for me, she says, how many times you can be married. So how can I know? We begin with the soul that proclaims its innocence through ignorance. Well, there's this, there's that, somebody told me this. Well, I know there's this gospel story, but how can I know? Nobody's ever told me definitively, so I've had... And then she makes a defense. Men may divina and gloss and up and down, but well he won't express without a lee, God bade us for to waxa and multiply... It. That gentle text can I well understand. God gave the order, go forth and multiply. Well, that's all I'm doing, she says. That I understand. That's clear. So I'm following God's order. Except she never mentions a child. All the talk is of husbands, and as far as we can tell, she is barren. All the marriages are barren. So that the purpose and end of marriage is nothing that has occupied her in any case. This is a case, and we assume this, nothing is said about it, but it's I think, an evident omission. If she had children, we would have heard about it because she talks about everything. She tells us everything. So we assume we would have heard about it. But please notice she's trying to make a little defense of herself. Well, I can tell you why I'm married so often, because we were told to go forth and multiply. That's what I'm doing. That's why I've had so many husbands. Okay. Now, her conscience is not clear. And we see it because she keeps on making these arguments that our positive chop logic make no sense. Her intellect is not the best. But we do have the sense of a troubled conscience because she keeps trying to excuse herself. The first excuse, nobody ever told me I don't know how many times I should be married. The second excuse, but I did read what God said, go forth and multiply. That's what I've been doing. So I've been married a lot. The next one is this. Virginity is perfection. I know that, she says. Okay, virginity is perfection. Virginite is great perfection, and continence ache with devotion. But Christ, that of perfection is wella, bade not every wicked he should go sell all that he had and give it to the poor. Now, virginity is the model. That's the best. But Christ didn't tell everyone he met, go sell everything you have and give it to the poor and follow me. He just said it to one person, and therefore, he doesn't expect us all to be perfect. Therefore, he doesn't expect everyone to be a virgin. And therefore, since I'm imperfect, I'm not a virgin. Got it? Woof. Woof. Please. Woof. She goes further. If it was assumed I would be imperfect, okay, and it was known that I would be imperfect, therefore I can't live in perfect chastity. For that reason, I have license from God to indulge my imperfection. He made me. He knew I couldn't be perfect. He knew I was going to be imperfect. Therefore, knowing me, he expects me to be imperfect. Because otherwise, he would have called me to perfection, and he didn't, because I'm not a virgin. Whoa, man. Seminarians, imagine a little training exercise for you. This woman comes into the confessional. Little training exercise for you, okay? Sort this one out. Whoa! Okay. At that time, having been ordained, God will give you the grace to respond. But this is just, oh man, you read through this, you listen to her arguments, your head starts hurting. Oh, gracious. Oh, gracious. Just a little touch of this. It's just amazing. Christ was a maiden and shapen as a man, and many a saint since the world began. Yet lived there they are ever in perfect chastity. E nil envio no virginite, let him be bread of purer wheat a seed, and let us weave us hot and barley bread. And yet with barley bread Mark can tell a con, or Lord Jesus refreshed many a man. I'm not pure white bread like a virgin, okay? I'm barley bread. And yet we know with barley bread, our Lord fed multitudes. Therefore, I should feed multitudes? And curiously, that's what indeed she's been doing. Oh, let me continue. In switch a start as God hath clepped us, I will persevere. God made me this way, I will persevere in the way he made me. Enam not precious. In weefood I will use mine instrument as freely as me maker hath it sent. God gave me my instrument, therefore I meant to use it freely. If e be dangerous, God gave me sorrow, mean husband shall it have both Eve and Morwa, when that him list come forth and pay his debtor. I will do my wifely duty whenever my husband comes forward and wants me to, as long as he pays his debt to me. And husband, he will have, he will not letter, which shall be both me detour and me thrall, and have his tribulation withal upon his flesh, while that he am his wife. If he comes to me, then I'm going to be a wife to him, and he's going to have his tribulation through me. She's going to repeat this later when she gives some examples of her actual marriages. Woo! Woo! Those of you who are married, just thank God. This woman was out there. She obviously was attractive in her youth, she will tell us. You know, you could have wound up with her. Okay. almost did. Came close, but escaped from that one. Yes, yes, indeed. Now, she begins by talking about her husbands, and the first three get grouped together. They don't even have any individuality. They're all of a piece. The first three men she married were old and had money. They were obviously attracted to her for the same reason that John the Carpenter in The Miller's Tale is attracted to Yonga Alasun, okay? And they made those marriages. All three married her, and she simply says, "He governed him so well after me law that each of him full blissful was, and for to bring him me gay things from the fair." She married them and she made their lives very happy because she governed them so well after her own law. She decided what marriage would be like. She decided how they would live together. They submitted to her and they were all very happy. They were so happy that when they went off to the local fair, they would bring her gifts home. Very happy marriages. Very happy marriages. Especially then, each one died and she got all their goods. And then off she'd go on another pilgrimage and find another husband. An old man, okay? Same thing. This is the first three. These are the first three, okay? I got to tell you, she's done a little bit of reading. She goes into some philosophers. She quotes biblical examples. She quotes from some of the church fathers. All we can say, I'll just summarize it this way. I'll quote the great Alexander Pope, "A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or touch not the Pyrian spring." Okay, she has a little bit of learning. She's got a little bit of learning, and again, she's using it. She's using it in order to excuse herself. She goes through in detail how she made those husbands submit to her. If there was ever any trouble, okay, she made it very clear she was in charge. She was always in charge. Oh, this is... It goes on. I'm just giving little touches along the way. Read the whole thing. It is brilliant. Here's one. She's explaining why the wife should be in charge in a marriage. Here we go. "Certain we shall you teacha that it is fair to have a wife in peace." You're much happier if your wife is peaceful, okay? "One of us two most to bow and do to less." If you've got two people in a marriage, one has to bow down before the other. She understands that. Makes good sense. Can't have two captains of the ship. She knows that, okay? "And since the man is more raisonable than woman is, ye most ben sofrable." Women are not as reasonable. They can fly off the handle. They don't have man's intellect. They don't have man's reason. Therefore, men can understand why they're letting the woman be in charge and use their intellect and reason to say, okay, I'll submit to her, and then at least she'll be calm and there'll be peace in the marriage. So it is rational that the man should submit to the woman because he has the better intellect. Whoa! Whoa! Okay? "What aileth you to grocha thus and groana? Is it for ye wold to have me quenta alone? Why talk at all? Lo, have it every dale. Peter, I show you, but ye love it well. For if I wold to sell my bella shosa, I could a walk as fresh as is a rosa. But I will keep it for your own atotha. Ye be to blame be God, I say you sotha." Listen, I could be distributing my favors out in public. There are people out there who would pay for them. You submit to me, I'll stay home, it's yours, and you'll be very happy and peaceful and content. And you'll understand why, because you're a reasonable man. You're a man, you have intellect, you'll understand that. So do you want war or do you want peace? You submit to me, you'll have peace. The fourth husband, we get a very brief summary. "Me fourth husband was a revelor, that is to say he had a paramour." The fourth husband had another woman on the side. "And he was young and full of rajaria, stubborn and strong and jolly as a peer." Well, I'm sorry, if she was still that young and attractive, why do you go wandering off? And after the first three husbands, what happens? She's beginning to lose her looks. She's beginning to lose her youthfulness. and the fourth husband she had some difficulty controlling. How could he dance to an harp a small and singy whis as any nightingale when I had drunk a draught of sweet wine? Metellius the foolish chair of the Sweena, that with a staff bereft his wife her leaf, for she drank wine, though he had been his weef, he should not have daunted me from drinka, and he tried to tell her what to do. This fourth husband tried to tell her what to do. And after wean on Venus most he thinka, for also sicker is cold engendereth hail, a licorous mouth most a han a licorous tail. In women venolent is no defensa. This canoan lechers by experienza. I was going to have my wine, and I was going to have my physical pleasures. And he wasn't about to tell me no. And that's all we hear of him. And he disappears. And then comes the passage. And then comes the passage that makes her human. Okay? Let me see if I can find it in here. It's just after her description of that fourth husband. 271. Yes, yes, yes. 271. Top of 271. But Lord Christ, when that it remembereth me upon me yotha, and on me jalite, it tickleth me about mean herta rota. Unto this day it doth mean herta bota, that ye have had me world as in me tima. But aja, alas, that all willa envenenima hath me bereft me beauté and me peace. Lot go, farewell, the devil go therewith. The floor is gone, there is no more to tella. The bren, as ye best ken, new musty cellar. But yet to be wreaked merry will ye fonda, now will ye tell of my fourth husband. And she gives a little bit about it. What happens? She admits, my youth is gone. Time is going on. My best days are behind me. And it troubles her. It troubles her. And out of that, what have we got? Well, it's that clear sense. At that moment, loneliness, sorrow, regret, the coming of age, there is a heart that is beginning to feel remorse. And she states it openly. And she admits that her flowers, she's given up the flower, all that's left to her is the bran. That's all she's got left to sell. She is open for guidance. Okay? She is open for guidance. I skipped over something in her prologue. The partner interrupts her at one point. The partner interrupts her and says, oh boy, I listened to you, and boy, I came close to marrying, I'm glad I didn't. She basically says, be quiet, and keeps talking. At the end, the friar and the sumner are going to begin disputing each other. Three of these ecclesiastical figures surround the wife of Bath. When we get to the pardoner's tale, I'll explain it, but there is a reason why, if you will, they are connected with her when clearly the one she needs is the parson. At this moment, she is in need of that good priest. And there are things in his sermon that are clearly directed to her. Directed to her. Does she listen? We don't know. We don't know. But I'll come back to that. But what we get as she speaks, as she goes through her prologue, is these other three who are not in any way admirable and are only out for themselves. They're the ones who connect themselves with her. Okay. Now, the fourth husband dies as she's coming home from Jerusalem. Again, probably looking for number five. He's buried. God give his soul rest. He's in the grave. And then we get the fifth husband. And we get a reversal. Being older, she now has a handsome young husband. Okay? Situation reversed. She was young and beautiful. She had three old men for husbands. Now she's older and she's got a young man and she's been attracted to him. She's been attracted. Again, it's not a proper marriage. It's a marriage for the wrong reasons. But suddenly she is the one who's feeling passage. passion, and she says, Itro I loved him best, for that he was of his love dangerous to me. She loved him best of the five husbands because he threatened her. And she says, I still bear on my ribs the pain of when he beat me. But she loved him best. What have we got? Number five is obviously a real man. And he has not stopped short of giving her a good pounding when she needs it. And she says, I loved him best because he was a dangerous man. She finally confronts manhood. And then, however, the tiger won't change its stripes easily. We've got war. We've got battle here. And she goes about her business trying to subdue him, and the more she tries to subdue him, what does he do? He's hauling out those books and reading to her about how a wife submits to the husband. And it drives her crazy. Every night in front of the fire, he makes her listen as he reads to her about how a wife submits to the husband. And she retaliates by going all over town telling all of his secrets to her friends. So this is the nature of the battle. He's reading to her what she should do, but he doesn't dare talk to her anymore because no matter what he does, she's going off and telling her friends, and hence the whole town knows. Okay. Well, it finally comes to a crisis. She tries to withhold the marriage debt from him. I love this. And Juan, he saw he would never fina to reading on this cursed book all nicked. He's reading these books every night, and she realizes he's not going to stop. He's not going to stop. He's not buckling under the way the others did. All suddenly three levers have a plicked oaked of his book, ricked as he read it, and ache I with me fist, so took him on the cheka, that in or fear he fell backward a doon. She's had enough, she grabs the book, she rips three pages out of it, and smacks him so hard across the face that he falls into the fire. It's a lovely marriage. And hey, upstairs doth a wold leon. He rises up like a crazy lion. The same image we had in the Knight's Tale when Palamon and Arcita start fighting each other. We're back at just passion, just raw passion. Except here now it's between a husband and wife, between a wife and her fifth husband. And with his fist he smote me on the head that in the floor I lay as I were a dead. He just gives it right back. He strikes her right across the head. Bam! And down she goes and lies there as if she's dead. And when he saw how still that he lay, he was aghast and would have fled his way. He thinks he's killed her. She's aware of it. Okay? We're at the moment of crisis here. He thinks he's killed her. He's horrified. And it's so bad, he considers just running away from the house. Let the authorities find her body, he'll be gone. Till at a lasta, out of me squoch I bride. Until finally, she's aware of this. She resumes consciousness. It's a little act she's doing. Oh, hast thou slain me, false thief, he said. Oh, you tried to kill me. Did you try to kill me? And for Milan, thou hast murdered me. You're after my property, aren't you? All you want are my goods. Ere ye be dead, yet will ye kiss they. Well, I'm going to die, but I'll give you one last kiss before I expire. This old broad suddenly becomes a hurt young feminine thing, okay? And it works. And ne'er he come, and canaled fair adoon, and sighed a dearest sister, Alison, as help me God, he shall thee never smite. That he have doon, it is thyself to weeta, for if it may, and that I thee beseeka, and yet if soons he hit him on the cheeka. He comes down and says, oh, I'm so sorry. I'll never do that again, I promise you. Blam! She hits him one more time, showing the whole thing was a phony act, an absolute, and side of faith. Thus much le mi reca. Now will he die, I mean no longer speckin. Yeah, now I am going to die. But at a last, with mutual care and woe, we fill accorded by a selvan two. He eff me all the breedle in mean horn to hand the governance of hosts and land, and of his tonga and of his hond also, and made him brenna his book anoon rick though. And when that he had a getten unto me by mastery or the sovereignty, and that he said a mean own a truer weef, do as thee lust the term of all thee leaf, cape thine own oar and cape ache mean a start, after that day we had a never debat. He turns over everything to her. Okay, you win. You win. He burns the book. He turns over his lands to her. He turns over everything to her. She has full mastery. She has full governance. She's in charge of the marriage. And they never fight again. But she's off on another pilgrimage. It's the end of him. It's the end of him.